Welcome to, I think, the 24th episode of Cartoon Avatars. We're doing a special bonus emergency podcast. I'm your host, Logan Bartlett, and I'm joined today on a Saturday by none other than Axios's very own Dan Primack. Dan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We're running it back. I think it was April or something we did this, and it was kind of short notice. I think it was right after he had said he was going to buy Twitter, and he had the TED Talk that day. The TED interview, whatever. And we weren't really sure how serious Elon was about the whole thing. And I guess we've kind of gotten our answer now. Here we are, whatever, 3 months later. And to some extent, now we know, I guess.
You know what's interesting about that TED Talk? I forgot that was the day we did it. My recollection of that was, you know, and he talked about a lot of things that weren't Twitter specific. But when it came to Twitter, just how little he had thought through some of the issues, particularly the content moderation issues, which are the things he got asked about during that. You know, his concept of free speech. Okay, what does that practically mean when you get into some tricky situations and you have to have humans as opposed to AI making the choices? He really had not given it a hell of a lot of thought. And I think kind of the gist of all of this is he didn't give any of this a lot of thought. He flew into this deal so quickly. And now he's realized he went too quickly.
So maybe the state of play, like where we are right now, for people that don't live this stuff like maybe you and I do, like where are we at this moment in time? You know, that was 3 months ago. Like sort of what's transpired and what's happened, what's transpired in 3 months and then what's transpired in the last 24 hours?
All right, so let's go back. Let's go back 3 months ago in March. I think actually it was in March. Elon apparently started buying stock in Twitter, a significant amount of stock. He disclosed that publicly at the beginning of April. We've learned that at the end of March, he at least started having some conversations with Jack Dorsey, the former Twitter CEO, who at the time was on the company's board, just generally about kind of social media and the future, et cetera. Once he disclosed the stake in Twitter, he said he was a passive investor, not looking to buy it, just along for the ride. He had some ideas. Twitter basically offered him a board seat. He accepted it, and then he changed his mind very, very quickly. And then a little while later said he wanted to buy the company. The company didn't want to be sold to Elon Musk, even at a really high price. The board put in what they call a poison pill, which is kind of a defensive measure to say, stop, Elon, don't do this.
And they were trading around the time. So his offer was a 420 joke, obviously. And so it was 5420 was the offer. They were trading at the time where, like $45 a share, something like that?
You think so, in the low 40s, I think. It was a good premium. It was a good price. And again, you know, remember, we're talking about early April. There was a tech correction starting, you know, in the NASDAQ, but it wasn't anywhere near what we saw in the subsequent months.
Yeah, I think I saw Snap is down maybe since the moment it's down 52% or something. And Meta, Facebook's down, whatever, 27%.
Yeah, Tesla's lost $285 billion of market cap since then.
Gosh. And that's what, 30% or something?
Something, I'm not sure the number, yeah.
Okay, so that was the moment in time. And so he said, Twitter said, no, you can't buy us. And he said, I really want to. They put in a poison pill as a defensive mechanism, which I think on that Thursday, I went back and kind of listened to it. We were speculating that that could happen. And then they introduced it, I think, over the weekend on Friday. And everyone lost their minds. Hey, Twitter's, you know, you have to sell it to Elon. You can't introduce a poison pill. This is the right thing for your shareholders, right? Which is ironic now.
And let's remember that, right? Because the folks who were on Elon's side back then, that was the argument they were making. How dare you, Twitter board, how dare you not take this deal? You are screwing over your shareholders. You have a fiduciary duty to accept this bid. By the way, they didn't necessarily. You don't always have to take a high bid or the highest bid. We're seeing this right now kind of play out with Spirit Airlines.
It's like, hey, you know, the next company he does this for, this is the second time he's fake taken a company private. And I think they will have ground to stand on to say, hey, by the way, whatever he says probably isn't going to hold up, right?
Absolutely. But that said, the Twitter board caved, right? You know, that weekend, they have negotiations with him back and forth. And ultimately, Elon gets basically everything he wants. You know, he doesn't go up in price because it's already a high price. He doesn't have to pay an extraordinary breakup fee for walking away. It's $1 billion for him. It's $1 billion for Twitter. And Twitter's board basically says, okay, you can buy the company. And that's where we kind of sat for a little while.
And they signed a definitive merger agreement, right? Yeah. Like within a week or whatever it was, right?
It's ironclad. By the way, think about that week. I think they signed it. I think they signed it maybe the third week of April or maybe the second week of April they sign it. They sign it less than 3 weeks after Elon discloses publicly his stake in the company. This is extraordinarily fast. I mean, I understand he's an individual, but talk to anyone, say, who's in private equity, who takes companies private for a living. They work for months and months and months working on these bids, you know, kicking tires, hopefully getting to do due diligence, learning everything they can, you know, working on financing. These things take forever. Elon just did it in a couple of weeks, in part because he said, I want to buy this. I have money and I'm going to buy it.
In an impulsive way, I'm dating myself a decade here, but once upon a time, I was a sell-side investment banker, right? And like, this is, you work, you run a process, you shop it around, you talk to different bidders, right? They did that process over the course of, I don't know, 48 hours. There's only a finite number of people that could buy a company for $45 billion or whatever it was. And so you can do some quick checks on that. And Twitter has been shopped in the past. And so, you know, presumably if there was interest, someone else would have expressed it. And then like—
Can I just add that for folks to understand, Twitter is a tough company to buy because the most logical buyers ever, right? Companies like Google, Apple, hell, Facebook— none of them could get this through antitrust. So the most logical buyers for Twitter aren't really in play here.
And then there were the random ones that poked around, whatever, 5 years ago, Disney, who, you Salesforce. Know, looked at it and said they didn't want to touch it. Salesforce, where Benioff had like kind of a pet project around it. So there were a few random ones that were kind of poking around. And then we had some private equity folks, right? Thoma Bravo was looking at it. I think Apollo was. There was a handful of like private equity people. But at the end of the day, the debt level that was needed to fund an acquisition was probably too high to make the math work for the financial return. And that was kind of the rub in my mind here was it was a weird bedfellow for Elon to have with any of these financial sponsors because he was saying, hey, I'm doing this for a social good purpose, right? I'm not doing this for financial purposes. And the money he needed were ultimately from financial sponsors to some extent. And so ultimately it kind of left him as the only potential buyer, right?
You really couldn't, and which is why, you know, so as you said, Thoma Bravo took a good hard look at it. Apollo got linked to it in the press, and folks kind of close to Apollo when that happened pushed back very, very hard and very, very quickly said, whoa, 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 whoa. We are talking to Elon just like we talk to anybody, but it's the debt side of our house that's talking to him. In other words, we may help finance this, but if we do so, or if Apollo does so, we'll do this via debt. We won't be a pure equity investor here. And that's obviously a very different thing. If you're a debt holder in the thing, you've got just different sorts of collateral. You've got much lower risk.
So Elon did minimal diligence at this point, right? Outside in diligence, signs the definitive merger agreement, which is I guess I'll let you speak to it, but it's pretty bulletproof as like barring, you know, something. I mean, there's a bunch of technical terms, but what does a definitive merger agreement actually mean in this situation?
It basically means you've agreed to buy the company, full stop. This is not, I've seen some comparisons. This isn't like buying a house, but then there's a contingency for a home inspection, right? It's like signing the agreement to buy the house after you've done the home inspection. There are no contingencies after it. Again, outside of some sort of outright fraud. For example, you can't get out of it just because the market's gone down or there's been, you know, a massive change in financing conditions. Several years ago during the financial crisis, some private equity firms tried to argue that, right? They said, we agreed to buy you before Lehman went under. Lehman goes under, all hell breaks loose. Now you're worthless. And they weren't able to get out of those deals unless they negotiated their way out. And in one case, one of those deals, and we'll talk about this later, I'm sure, went to court. And the private equity firm wasn't forced to buy it in the end, but they had to pay a hell of a lot of money to get out of it.
Yep. And so then we knew, I mean, the market's turning, right? And you could tell, I mean, at that point, like, even if you were, and it's not just turning like, hey, the other social media stocks are down, but he collateralized, he's able to come up with the financing, right? But it ends up being fairly heavily collateralized to his Tesla stock, which ultimately starts weighing down the Tesla stock. And so now he's in this position where Twitter, he paid a premium at the time of whatever, April, and now social media stocks are trading down and his net worth is tied to Tesla in a meaningful way. And that's trading down, which is part of the collateral to actually do the deal, right?
The Tesla stock, there's two pieces to it, right? First, he sells $8.5 billion worth of Tesla stock to help come up with his cash for the deal. And then he collateralizes more of it. Now, that collateral ends up disappearing because he ultimately gets some equity investors. Big ones, too. Sequoia Capital, Andreessen Horowitz, et cetera, come and kind of help take care of that. But he sold an enormous amount of Tesla stock. And one of the arguments for why Tesla has gotten its, you know, ass handed to it since this deal was first signed, outside of the fact the markets in general are down, is because Elon has always been so incredibly tied to Tesla in terms of his finances. He sold a lot, and he sold a lot kind of high to help finance this other thing. And I think there's certain Tesla shareholders who said, wait a minute, not only are you going to be distracted because you're now about to own a third or fourth or fifth company or whatever it is, you care a little bit less about Tesla because you're using this to finance it. So he got in high, and a lot of Tesla shareholders have been riding it down.
Yeah. And Zach Weinberg at the time, when we recorded that episode, whatever, 3 months ago, he was like, I just think this is a diversification play for him to try to get out of so much concentration in Tesla stock, which we'll come back to in a second. But it was interesting perspective now to look back on everything that transpired. I've actually heard a little bit of, and again, I don't know this, but I've heard some speculation from people that at the same time that Sequoia and DFJ and Andreessen Horowitz, and there's a handful of people that all committed to fund part of this, right, to different levels. Right. And it's interesting, like DFJ has a longstanding, their investors in SpaceX and Tesla, and Steve Jurvetson's good friends with Elon, as I understand it. And then, you know, when I had heard from a speculation standpoint from Andreessen Horowitz and Sequoia was that if you look, what else happened since all this transpired was Sequoia invested in the Boring Company. And, you know, who knows there. And then SpaceX raised around as well. And so one of the things that I had heard speculation on was that their commitment to actually finance this as a venture investment was actually to get access to the other products in the Elon Musk orbit, right? And so at the end of the day, like, it's interesting, there weren't, while a lot of financial sponsors stepped up to do this deal, it was, everyone sort of had some different agenda or potential reason that I saw people kind of speculating on of why they would actually do this. But to Elon's credit, he got the financing, right, in a meaningful way, which was something that, I don't know, a lot of people thought he would have to fund it all out of pocket, right?
Right. And look, and whether or not there were ulterior motives or not, one thing has been true for venture capitalists since Elon showed up, you know, with you know, when he joined PayPal originally. Betting on Elon Musk for as an investor, particularly as a startup investor, has paid off, right? If you were a VC in Tesla, you made a ton of money. If you were a VC in SpaceX, maybe you haven't cashed in yet, but you know, you're well in the black on that deal. It's worked out in PayPal, obviously. So it's very much worked out. And very, with a couple exceptions, most investors in this didn't put an enormous amount of money in, at least nowhere close to, you know, this $44 billion price. They put in, you know, $100, $150 million, which for VC funds is still a lot, but it's not a break the bank sort of thing for a lot of the ones who put in.
You know, it's funny. I thought Sequoia was actually far higher. I thought Sequoia was like 500 or something. Yeah.
And I think Larry Ellison might be.
Right. Larry Ellison was a billion. Gosh, what a weird group of bedfellows that all kind of came together on this. I would love to hear the conference call that has transpired with all these different people. So that was a big milestone, right? And at that point, I was kind of like, you know, we can go back. I've been thankfully recording a podcast for 6 months or whatever it's been talking about this, but we can go back. And I think I was like, oh shit, this is actually going to happen now, presumably. But we started to see some cracks in the process start playing out, right? And so I guess it led to a moment in which, I don't know if you have a different moment in the process that you think back on, but there was the temporarily on hold kind of bot thing, right? And I think maybe he had tweeted a little bit kind of speculation about bots and poking around bots and all that. But that was the moment that, you know, declaring temporarily on hold isn't actually a thing, right? When you've signed a definitive merger agreement, but he said it. And there was a Friday that came out, right? Was that the next big milestone in your mind?
That was a huge milestone. As you say, he has talked about bots, and he's called them spam bots on Twitter, actually going back a couple of years. You know, people in the last 24 hours have been pulling up a lot of tweets. The idea that bots or spam on Twitter was a new issue for Elon, or something he wasn't aware of, or something he cared about, just isn't true. He's cared about it for a while. And in fact, even after agreeing to buy it, there's a tweet or two, I can't remember if he put them out independently or if they were in replies to people, talking about how bots, from his perspective, were a big problem with Twitter. And it was one of the reasons he wants to buy it. He was going to help clean that up and clear the platform of it. And if you think about Elon Musk's experience on Twitter, which I don't quite understand how he could actually use it because he gets so many replies to everything he writes, no matter what it is. But so much of that, particularly because of some of the crypto stuff, is spam. He sees more spam by far than your average Twitter user would see. So for him, it's something he was aware of. And as you say, he, quote, put it on hold. It's not a real thing. Twitter's response was, deal still moving forward. And you would talk to people around the deal on both sides of it. the bankers and stuff, they were all, and the lawyers, they were all still meeting. Elon might have said it was on hold, but the people who actually were doing the paperwork and the real work of this, they hadn't stopped.
Yeah, and a couple hours after he said it was on hold, he said, I still intend to acquire Twitter or something, and who knows what gun was held to his head or what person actually typed that tweet from his account to put it out there, right?
Well, remember, the other piece of this is, of course, you know, we'll talk about this issue of Delaware and courts and how mergers get enforced. The SEC is also still sitting here, right? Elon is a major stockholder in Twitter. And by the way, we have no idea if he has bought more shares or if he's sold shares throughout this process, but he's a major shareholder. So when he makes comments like this deal is on hold, this 54.20 a share is on hold, that can impact the stock price. That could, in theory, help make him or lose him money, but definitely hurt or help other investors. And the SEC is paying very close attention, which is why I think he had to backtrack real fast.
Yeah. And then the next milestone in my mind, I think it might have been the following Monday, was the All In guys had their conference down in Miami, and they had him come on. And it was funny. They sort of talked through the bot problem, and Elon had a bunch of, you know, funny quotes. And obviously, he has a very different worldview than the average person in terms of, like, his experience on Twitter. Well, his experience in general, probably, yeah. Right? But on Twitter specifically. And he said that the low end of estimates that he has is that it's 20% bots, right? And he thinks it could be up to 80, 90%. And then Calacanis came back to him and said, hey, but there's obviously some price, right? If you get to an answer in which you would do it. And I was trying to find the clip, and hopefully it's still up on YouTube, but he paused for a second. This is like on May 16th or something. And he paused for a second and he goes, you could tell he said, like, his answer was something to the effect of, like, yeah, maybe, yeah, there could be a price potentially that I would do this deal. And I remember watching that at the time, and I was like, oh, this guy has no intention of following through on it, right? He's caught this bus. The market's turned. He's seen all this stuff happen, right? He's sort of gotten, it's like a be careful what you wish for, or like the dog that ultimately got, you know, caught the bus on all this stuff. And you could see it in his face that, like, I don't intend to go through with it, right? And whatever that was May 16th or something, 2 months ago, roughly. And that was kind of the last big milestone that I remember, right, that was actually going on of, like, okay, I don't think this guy intends to go through with it.
I agree. And look, one thing I don't know, because I'm not inside Elon's head, I don't know how sincere the bot issue is to him. Like, is this really something that somehow just hit him like a thunderbolt? He was like, oh my, I made a terrible miscalculation here, and now I'm going to blame the company for hiding the ball. Or is this just pure cold feet and regret, and this is the only thing he can figure to hang his hat on? I tend to think it's the latter, because again, he kind of knew there was a bot issue. He has no actual evidence that it's 20% or 15% or even 5% or under 5% as Twitter said. He doesn't. And when you look at his, you know, statement yesterday about why he's walking back, he doesn't have a real claim. He doesn't really have a number. He's just complaining that he doesn't have the data to get to a number. He doesn't actually know.
Let's go there. So that was like May 16th, right? And in between then and yesterday or 2 days ago, or the one the Washington Post story broke, he did an all hands with the company, right? Was there anything else, like, really material that happened, or it was kind of like, you know, running the course of a normal closing a deal process?
I thought the all hands was telling. I thought the all hands was telling because, for those who didn't see it, he did it on a cell phone, like on a FaceTime sort of app, from what looked like either a hotel room or a conference room with some people kind of milling about behind him. Look, Elon's obviously unconventional, but he knows that there are thousands of people internally at Twitter whose livelihoods are based on this company, and that this is his first time he's directly addressing these people. It looked like he hadn't prepared for it at all. It looked like he didn't give a shit, to be honest. It was like, oh, I've got to take this call from this person. Don't worry, I'll be there in 5 minutes to deal with the other stuff I have to do. And it looked like he was fairly dismissive. And then the actual conversation itself was some weird rambling stuff, you know, stuff about robots, et cetera. It struck me at the time watching it, he wasn't treating any of this. It wasn't even that he wasn't treating it seriously. It's like he didn't care anymore. It was like he was a little bit checked out of it still. Yeah. And he was only there because, you know, he had been forced to be there.
He's LARPing as like a robber baron or whatever, M&A person here. Yeah. And so the other thing, I guess, that happened, obviously the market continued to sell off over the course of the last, whatever, 2 months.
Can I point out one other thing happened in this process in the middle here, which had nothing officially to do with Twitter, but it was notable. Elon had settled with the SEC several years ago, the last time he, quote, tried to take company private, which was Tesla. And he had signed a settlement with the SEC because he had said he had, quote, funding secured when he didn't. And the settlement involved a lot of things, including that all of his tweets about Tesla, or at least material tweets about Tesla, had to be vetted by company lawyers, et cetera. He tried to get out of that deal. He actually basically filed a lawsuit or some sort of legal claim in court, said, I want out of the deal I signed a couple of years ago. While all of this is going on with Twitter, a court said no to him. So while all of this is happening, there was a separate deal, essentially, or agreement he tried to get out of, and a court rejected him, said, nope, you can't get out of this. And it's just kind of notable that, again, that while Twitter is going on, he's already lost the lawsuit about trying to get out of an agreement he had signed.
And it was funny, in the original merger agreement, he said that there was some term of like no disparagement to Twitter, right? And, you know, that was thrown out the window pretty quickly in all of this, right?
Yeah, there was pretty good arguments that he violated that very quickly in terms of some tweets, particularly that he made about the company's general counsel, who's the person who does or doesn't, you know, have the final call on blocks, like on major figures like Donald Trump.
Yep. And so then after that, right, there was a handful of interviews or comments about like, oh, I'm going to let Trump back on the platform. Twitter, in running their business, they did, I think there were kind of three things that were mentioned in the document from the lawyers yesterday. But three different things kind of happened with them running their business on normal course and speed as a potential recession is looming, or at least a some form of downturn. So Parag, the CEO, fired two executives, right? One was Kayvon, the head of product, and I forget who the other one was, but there were two people fired. Then they laid off one third of the talent acquisition team, which is, again, like, hey, you're probably not hiring a lot of people. Talent acquisition is basically recruiters. And so, like, if you're going to slow down, you know, and what's ironic about all this is, like, Elon wanted to, he's made jokes about laying off, you know, a portion of the team and that it can run much more efficiently and all that. So, like, again, not something that he would normally care about. And it feels like that's running the business in normal course and speed, right? And then the third was there were three executives that resigned, probably as a result of this clown car that's going on right now. But he cited the three of those. And so that those three things kind of happened as well over the course of the last, whatever it's been, 6 weeks or something, right? But the term is that the company will use its commercially reasonable efforts to conduct the business of the company and its subsidiaries in the normal, ordinary course of business, right? And so that was the term. And I think all of those things, like, fall within that, right? At least that's my speculation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's some folks who think, oh, the minute you sign a merger agreement, the company has to look exactly the same the day Elon takes it over. That's just not reasonable. It's never true in an acquisition, right? That you've got six, you know, this deal was supposed to close by October. So you had, what, 6-8 months? Things change at companies. People leave. Some people do get fired. The idea that you have, and I think he talked in there about kind of a hiring freeze and those layoffs you referred to, that's true of basically almost every tech company in the Valley and elsewhere right now. To be honest, if Parag hadn't done that, if he hadn't instituted a hiring freeze and maybe laid some people off in talent acquisition, that could be argued that that's not in the ordinary course of business, because that's what every other business is doing right now. And again, for the few folks who left, people leave companies over 8 months, particularly a company as large as Twitter. And it's not like, you know, the entire C-suite resigned overnight or something like that. That didn't, or the entire engineering team left.
And there has been, there was one precedent, right? Thoma Bravo buying Anaplan over the last couple weeks or whatever, in which I think Thoma Bravo tried to negotiate around, it was something related to stock options or RSUs granted to employees or something.
Right.
And basically, they threatened, I think, to walk away from the deal over this, what is normal course and speed. And at the end of the day, I think it ended up being like they lowered the purchase price by $100 million on like a $10.5 billion acquisition, something that was like very de minimis in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, it was fairly small. I think it was a little more than that in terms of cash. But yeah, they argued that there had been some bonuses and some compensation paid to people that shouldn't have been paid or that wasn't part of the original agreement. Anaplan, for what it's worth, disagreed with that. But from Anaplan's perspective, they were still getting so much more than the stock would normally have been valued at. Because again, this was a kind of a pre-correction deal. It just wasn't worth them taking the fight to court.
Yeah, exactly. They just kind of said, hey, we disagree with what you're doing. We think you're just trying to renegotiate a better deal, but let's come up with a price that, you know, we'll take a small discount to this just to get you to move forward.
Right. And remember, Thoma Bravo didn't say, we're leaving, we're walking away from the deal. They simply wanted a slightly better price, and then they negotiated a better price.
So now here we are, whatever. 2 days ago, Washington Post breaks a story that that the deal is on thin ice or something. I forget the actual terms they used. And then what's happened since then in the last, whatever, 48 hours?
Elon filed on Friday at, I don't know, maybe 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern time or so with the SEC and said, well, for starters, he went to Sun Valley. So I guess he either did it from there or his lawyers did it from there. And he filed with the SEC and said, I don't want to do this deal anymore. I want out. And here's my reasons why, as you know, as we've stated, it's in part because there's been, from his perspective, some changes to the company. There's this bot issue. And he says he wants to walk away. It is unclear if he thinks he should or shouldn't have to pay the $1 billion. It almost reads like he thinks Twitter should have to pay him $1 billion for violating the merger agreement. But he basically said he's going to try to walk away. Twitter responded very quickly. First, his chairman, Bret Taylor, who's also the co-CEO of Salesforce, and saying, no, we're not letting you walk away. We'll see you in court. We'll see you in court in Delaware, which is where these things get heard, something called Delaware Chancery Court, which everybody will get to learn a lot about. It's kind of a business-specific court. It's a weird one. Their filings, for example, you can't just get them online like every other court. You have this cool little like group of people who are little storefronts around the court that go and get files for people like me. And I think a lot of reporters are about to learn the finer points of Wilmington.
I was going to say, I feel like you and Matt Levine's careers have all built to this moment. Like, just, you know, it's all been one crescendo coming up on like going into Delaware court and law and all this stuff, right? This is sort of the, very arcane technical rules of law associated with business and, you know, diva tech personalities and financing and all that stuff. No, it's a certainly interesting. And so his three reasons, that he sort of outlined as I took it down was, one was the bots, right? And he just said that the estimate provided was different than what he believes. He says
he believes it's different, and that's important. He doesn't actually have any evidence, right? You can't just kind of say, I think there's fraud. You know, David Sachs, who's a friend of Elon's, part of the All In crowd, he tweeted today that, you know, what's going to really happen here is they're going to get into court and Elon's going to get to do discovery, and then Twitter's going to be on the defensive because their numbers are going to be wrong. I don't think that's really how this is going to work. You know, he can't just get to go on a fishing expedition to find some fraud inside of Twitter. He's got to present to the court he has evidence of some fraud at Twitter. That's how this is going to work. If you look at the filing with the SEC that Elon made, he talks about that Twitter didn't provide certain data, but he says this data was requested in due diligence letters or due diligence requests, all of which are after he signed the merger agreement. They're in May. Well, at that point, Twitter doesn't have to give him shit if they don't want to. The due diligence requests, you do those typically before you've signed the merger agreement. Then the company either decides to give you that information or not give you that information. And then you decide to do the deal. You don't have a right to it afterwards. It's just not how it works.
And that was the thing that I kind of took through you can drive a truck through the qualifications that Twitter gives around that 5%. The terminology they use is, this estimate is based on an internal review of a sample of accounts, and we apply significant judgment in making this determination. So like, that gives a lot of latitude to how they came about doing this, right? And so for Elon to actually get away on that point with the terminology and the filings with the SEC that they actually had, that feels like that is pretty ironclad. Not to mention the timing of like when he's actually doing this after the merger agreement has been filed, but that is not a leg I think that he's going to be able to stand on. Do you?
I don't think so. Unless he has some evidence of intentional fraud, right? Some email or something from an executive saying, we've been cooking the books. It's worth noting that the actual merger agreement is like 75 pages long or something like that. The word user, the term MDAU, spam, bot, none of those words appear even once in that entire agreement because they're not part of the agreement.
And then the second thing that you outlined there was, and this was kind of the second point that they brought up, was that they're not giving him enough information about the bots. And my understanding is they've given him access to the Twitter firehose, which is basically, I think it's pretty much a stream of all information, right, that's going on the platform. And he's asked for a few kind of, it seems arcane or just like pedantic requests around. One of the things I read was that he's asking for daily information on the MDAO calculation for the last 2 years. And so like, You know, I assume they're not doing this calculation daily, right? That's my assumption, is they probably do a sample on maybe a weekly basis, maybe every other week, maybe, like, this probably isn't a daily calculation that they're trying to get to this 5% number. And so I actually think it's kind of arbitrary altogether that this request isn't even something that exists in my mind.
See, I don't know if it exists or not, but it goes back to the Twitter's perspective on this is we don't need to give you this. You signed the agreement. If you wanted this, there was a time to ask for it, and maybe we would have given it to you or maybe not. There's also something in the merger agreement that says that Twitter does not have to provide him with information, and I'm going to paraphrase this now, doesn't have to provide him with information if its public disclosure could release some sort of confidential information about the company, et cetera. And I think they have reason to believe that Elon would publicize any confidential information they gave because he has kind of a habit of shooting from the hip. Again, that's not to say they are or aren't hiding the ball. I have no idea if the number is 5% or 50%. No idea. But again, you figure that out before you agree to pay $44 billion and sign the papers.
Yep. And so he made a few other requests that they haven't delivered to him, I guess, which is a bottoms-up working financial model, a working copy of Goldman Sachs's valuation model for its fairness opinion, which I think is hilarious. Like, some analyst at Goldman Sachs that pulled this like fairness opinion model together is probably like sweating bullets right now that's going to get pulled into discovery. I'm just picturing back to my investment banking days and like that I would be the center of like, you know, litigation and drama because of some like model I built at 2 a.m. on a Friday.
The irony of the model thing is because it's almost like Elon saying, well, the Goldman thing was very important because down to the penny, he picked 5420. The 420, as you said earlier, is a marijuana joke. The idea that the valuation, the specific number, you know, man, it's got to match up to what some analysts at Goldman said. You literally picked that number as a joke. And now, yeah. Like, come on.
Yeah, totally. He's probably pretty bummed that he wasn't able to work in a 69 joke as well as a 420 joke. Like, he has a childish. Yeah. So it was all arbitrary to begin with. And so, okay, so that's what happened yesterday. This was all filed. What happens now? Like, where do we go from here?
The assumption, and it's only an assumption, is that Twitter will file suit probably fairly soon in this Delaware Chancery Court, which is a business-specific court in Delaware. I would assume Twitter has been, if not anticipating this, at least preparing this. And so they've probably got the guts of a case already written, although obviously they need the specifics of what Elon wrote. So most likely Twitter will sue. And Elon will probably countersue. And when Twitter sues, they'll be suing for something called specific performance, which is this term. It's in this merger agreement. It's in most merger agreements, whereby the court literally could, if it chooses to, could force Elon to buy the company. Delaware Chancery actually has the right to do that. They have done it before. There's an old case of the guy who founded Tyson Foods, the chicken company, where he was forced to buy something like 20 years ago or 25 years ago, which is kind of the seminal case in this. Now, normally, that's not what they do. Normally, they say to the two sides, you know, get your shit together. We're going to come up with a number. You know, Elon, you're going to have to pay not a $1 billion breakup. You're going to have to pay, I don't know, several billion dollars, maybe surrender your stock, which is worth whatever. That's how it usually works. But in theory, they could force him to buy the company for $54.20. And just to play this out a little bit, what we don't know, because no one's ever done this before, is we don't know what would happen if Elon said no. In other words, the court rules and says you owe $44 billion. And Elon just says, not going to pay it. Delaware Chancery does not typically put people in jail. I think I spoke to somebody who's kind of a longtime watcher of the court. And they said, in their knowledge, once, like in like 30 years, somebody, one of the judges referred a defendant for a criminal prosecution. That happened kind of once. But they don't really put people in jail. There is the SEC, however, who could get involved. And they have a lot more hammers and a lot more levers.
Yeah, so I want to go there in a second, but do you think, I guess this is total speculation, but I have my opinion, is this a renegotiation tactic or is this a walk away? Do you think he's trying to get a price at $40 a share that he would do it or $35 a share that he would do it? Or do you think he doesn't want to do this? He's had his fun and is ready to go home.
I mean, I get the sense he's ready to go home because we have not heard from anybody that he has, like, and you'd think it would have leaked by now that he was trying to renegotiate, right? We haven't seen that story, and I haven't heard from anybody on either side of this. Oh, Elon really wants this at 42, but, you know, the board is saying no. Like, that conversation hasn't happened. Now, is that where this could end up? Sure. Once lawsuits are filed, kind of in all parts of, you know, whether they be civil or whatever, sides settle. And that might be something that comes out of this again, or this thing could go through court and you could just end up with a financial settlement where Twitter continues to be a publicly traded company. Elon's not a part of it, but he had to pay dearly to get out of it.
Yeah. And that's kind of my, you know, if you go back and watch that All In clip, right, he, Calacanis gives him the out of, hey, you want a lower price. So that's kind of the issue here. And he's like, ah, maybe, but maybe not. And so my speculation the entire time is he just wants out full stop and he's had his fun and done this whole thing.
And to that point, by the way, if you really thought that you know, say if he thought it was a 20%, you know, there was 20% of the users on Twitter were bullshit, were spam. He could, in theory, come up with some calculation saying, okay, you have this much ad revenue. We're going to divide that. You know, we're going to, you know, give a 20% discount or pick a number. This is how much the company's really worth. And that's what I'm willing to pay because you lied to me about the spam. He hasn't done any of that.
Yeah. And that kind of goes back to the Anaplan Toma Bravo thing was like, at the end of the day, both they agreed to some, hey, we don't agree with what you're doing, but like, let's adjust to some price that you're willing to do. And I think they basically made an ironclad, you know, whatever reps associated to get them to actually close. And I think raised the breakup fee and all of that. But my perspective is Elon just doesn't want this. He just wants right. out altogether. So, all right. So we can litigate it through Delaware court, right?
By the way, of course he wants out. Good God. Owning Twitter. Like, of all companies to have to own and run, is there a bigger headache company, you know, in the world than Twitter? The former CEO of Reddit had a great thread when Elon agreed to buy this where you know, he kind of broke apart a lot of what Elon thought about running a social media company. But it boiled down to, you have no idea the hell you are signing up for here. And I think maybe Elon started to get a little bit more of an inkling of that.
Well, and it goes back to the very fundamental thing of his whole free speech premise of this. But then you start to like break down what free speech actually means. And should, you know, racism be allowed to exist on the platform? Should child pornography, should beheading, should all of these things, like free speech as a concept seems very reasonable, right? And I think no one is in the United States, anti-free speech as this absolute thing that doesn't actually, you know, whatever, doesn't actually mean anything. But when you get into the guts of like, should this be allowed or should it not, it starts to be very hairy. And that's what the Reddit CEO, I think really, or former one, really pointed out is how complicated this issue actually is.
Yeah, and Elon, to his credit, you know, he said anything that is illegal, child pornography, for example, you know, obviously he would have banned on the platform. But really where so much of this for Twitter comes out are things like targeted harassment of individuals and things like that, which is technically not illegal, you know, like child pornography would be, but it becomes very, very, very complicated if you're running one of these social media platforms.
Well, and also like beheading videos aren't actually illegal, right? Like beheading someone obviously is, but the video itself isn't illegal in the way that child pornography is. And so now what happens, right? And I know we don't actually have a crystal ball in all this, but we talked about Delaware courts and it's just, I can't imagine being Brett Taylor or Parag and not wanting to sell it and then agreeing to sell it and now taking someone potentially to court to try to sell it, right? But this whole thing has just been such a, you know, messed up emotional journey in all of this. And it's just kind of weird of like, that they're negotiating around no take backs or something like, no, now you have to buy this. And there's, I don't know how many employees Twitter has, 3,000 or so, 5,000, something like that. There's like a lot of people whose lives, livelihoods are at stake. Not to mention, I mean, I happen to think this is very close to a public utility and the product itself. There's a lot of important implications that go along with this. And so there's the Delaware court and that's going to play out that way. Then there's the SEC, which you touched on. And so what do you think the recourse is for the SEC here?
Well, the SEC has already got an investigation into Elon related to Twitter. And it's not about this, whether he buys the company or not. It's about when he disclosed his original stake in the company. And there's a period of time, I think it's 10 days, but I can't remember. So don't tie me to that. I wrote it at some point when I knew. After you acquire at least 5% of a public company, if you're an individual or if you're a hedge fund or whatever, you have to publicly disclose it within a certain period of time. There's a window, basically, so you can't manipulate the stock. Elon didn't do that. He disclosed his Twitter stake after that window was over, but actually almost by twice as long. And so the SEC is looking into that because that is illegal.
Wasn't his filing as well? He filed as a passive investor and then moved to activist before updating the paperwork as well. I mean, this is...
So arguably filed the wrong form also. So, but the time one is because he could argue maybe he thought he was passive and then he became active when he changed his mind. The time one is pretty simple. You have a certain number of days. We've all got a calendar. We can all figure that out. He didn't follow it. It's a really black and white thing. And it's, again, not like this is the first time he's run afoul of the SEC. He's done so before. The SEC does not, or at least historically, has never fined anybody anywhere close to the amount of money that would actually impact Elon Musk, right? Like that, you know, they could find him an amount that would bankrupt me and everyone I know and then all of their families and all of their families' families. And it wouldn't really touch Elon. They could, in theory, however, ban him from being a, you know, a director of a publicly traded company or an executive of a publicly traded company, which would mean Tesla and theoretically, if he ever wanted to take SpaceX public, that as well.
And so there's that's kind of the nuclear option in my mind, right? Because this is where one of the things I really struggle with Elon is I think he's so amazing as a entrepreneur and some of the things he's done in the world is just really, really special, like unique to, a one of one in terms of his ability to accomplish some of this stuff. And so the nuclear option of banning him from Tesla and SpaceX and the ability to serve on the board of all that feels almost too draconian, even though I think it's totally warranted, right? Like if this were anyone else, and that's kind of the whole conundrum here is if this were anyone else, you would just do that, right? And that would be the very simple recourse, I think. You fine them $1 billion or 500 million or some like really significant amount, and you ban them from serving on the public company. But both he has so much money and he's so important as a public figure that I just don't think you can go about doing that.
Yeah. So there's the other possibility, we talk nuclear options and it's hard for me to imagine because again, Delaware Chancery Court has never had to deal with enforcing a $44 billion merger, try to put somebody on the hook for it. If in theory they said, Elon, you offered the money, you got to pay it. It's $44 billion. A, it's unclear if his financing partners would stick around because he's already said he doesn't really want to buy it. And might he then have to sell more Tesla stock, tons more Tesla stock to afford it, and which kind of has its own trickle down. It could really hurt Tesla even more. That's in theory another nuclear option here. Elon's in a really bad position here. And for a really smart, it's funny, this is the second time he's gotten into this with trying to acquire a company from the outside. And for a guy who is extraordinarily smart, and as you said, I think one of the most important entrepreneurs, if not the most important entrepreneur of my lifetime, just in terms of what he's built and the diversity of what he's built, right? It's not like he built a computer company and then something that's sort of like a computer. Like yeah. He's gone these very different
ways. It's not Dave Duffield doing PeopleSoft and then Workday, right?
No, he's revolutionized, kind of moribund industries. That said, he's really bad at understanding kind of textbook basic M&A. He proved it when he, floated taking Tesla private, and he's proving it again here. And this isn't, Tuesday morning quarterbacking or Monday morning quarterbacking. A lot of us wrote that almost the day after he made this bid. He doesn't quite seem to understand how mergers and acquisitions work.
It's weird because he's been able to manifest so many things and defy so many things. So many points of gravity that is normal course and speed of business, right? Like there was a point in time in which Tesla was close to being an MLM kind of financing related thing. And he just kind of powered through it. And I think it was true then, but everyone doubted him and he got through it, right? And SpaceX and what he's been able to do there and Boring Company and all this stuff, like he almost lives in this world of willing things into existence. And I just have to imagine it's such a weird worldview that he must have that when he does something, it just works out, right? And it's just like, we all have that friend that like never finds themselves pinned down in any unfortunate situation because they're just able, the card turns over and it actually works out for him. And Elon's like the world's version of that like it just happens to work out. But finally, he's backed himself so much into a corner here that I just don't know. I mean, my guess is that there's going to be some dollar amount that he has to pay above and beyond the $1 billion breakup fee. That's material, right? And Twitter says it's not going to be the difference in Twitter stock price depreciation of what they're ultimately going to trade at. But Twitter's going to go back to having kind of a quasi miserable existence running this platform that has everyone on the world connected and spam and all that stuff. They're going to go back to that. And they'll have whatever, $1 billion to $5 billion in their coffer that they didn't have before, right? That's kind of my speculation on this. And ultimately, he gets some sanctioning from the SEC. But even then, like at the end of the day, like for him, that what's $1 billion to $5 billion among for Elon Musk, right? And so at the end of the day, I don't think it's ultimately going to impact him that much.
Although it could be $10, $15, $20 billion, right? Like, so I'd say two things. One, you're right. Elon's kind of willed things into existence or powered through. Right now, he'll have to make a final decision, obviously. But right now, this is out of his hands. This is about the lawyers on both sides, right? The lawyers are dealing with this now. And by the way, I'm sure he is paying them handsomely. So this is a billable hours issue now because Elon's not going to be the one coming up with a legal strategy here. I'd say on the other side, you know, Twitter is in an interesting spot with this too. And I know Ev Williams this morning kind of tweeted out something along the lines of, you know, I hope that Twitter is saying they're going to sue because they feel they need to legally, but that they let this whole thing kind of slide. They're not going to let it slide because they can't fiduciarily, but, you know, they've now got a company to run and they've got some, you know, they're going to try to force someone to buy it who doesn't want to own it and thus maybe doesn't want to run it. And you've got a lot of employees who some don't want them to buy it. Some wanted them to buy it. But for those who wanted them to buy it or at least expected them to, they might have stock options that were going to vest immediately when this deal went through at 54.20 a share. So a lot of these folks have financial reasons to care about this. So if Twitter were to simply say, you know what, Elon, go away, we'll put $1 billion in the bank, a lot of them are going to, you know, look at Bret Taylor and Parag and say, wait a minute. You guys, you know, basically promised me this money, and by bailing on it so quickly, I now can't, you know, can't pay off my mortgage as I expected to. And so they could have a little bit of employee uprising on a different side. I think for Twitter, they are in a very tough spot to say to some employees, you're not going to get paid, and say to others, we're going to try to force this guy to become your boss who doesn't want to become your boss.
Yeah, that's the hardest part about all this is ultimately, I think most of the rank and file employees would want this just to go away, right? And like, let's just move on. Let's go back to, but Twitter can't do that both because of the people that will sue because of their options if they don't pursue this to the ends of the earth, right? And then also like they owe it to all their shareholders to actually run this to ground, because this is a far better outcome than the stock trading at $28 a share or $26 a share or $22 a share or whatever it's going to be when this ultimately falls apart, right? And so, yeah, I have to imagine if you're Bret Taylor or Parag, you want this to go away. If you could wave your arms and say, hey, this never happened and we're just trading at $25 a share, like I'm sure they would probably prefer that path, but they actually can't do that, right?
No, and it's ironic, right? Because this is exactly why the Twitter board didn't want to accept his bid in the first place, right? I don't think there was ever a consideration at Twitter's board that, oh, you know, 54.20 is undervaluing the company. We don't want to sell it because it's a bad deal. Everyone knew from the outset the share price offered by Elon was a good price, beyond fair, right? Fair plus a premium. This, though, this mess, the idea that he could walk away, that he was inconsistent, that's why they didn't want to get into business with him, because they didn't necessarily trust him. And in the end, they kind of left those reservations aside and decided they were gonna roll with it. So it's kind of a problem their own making. They didn't stand firm when they should have. And I understand there was a lot of pressure on them, and there would have been a lot of second guessing, mainly from Elon's people. Yeah, again, who would have said, "How dare you not take this? This is a personal vendetta. This is because, you know, you're liberal and he's a libertarian or whatever." They kind of got into bed with the wrong guy, and they knew they were getting into bed with the wrong guy, and they did it anyway.
I can't imagine Jack Dorsey right now, by the way. Like, what? Jack
looks dumb. Jack looks real dumb right now.
I think he was kind of dumb the entire time, right? It was like he put Parag in place, and then he sort of backstabbed Parag a little bit in going with Elon at the time, right? And it seemed like when all that stuff was playing out, he was very much on the side of Elon here. And all the entire board, when he was still on the board, right, all this stuff was going on. Now he's off, but the entire board seemed very much against it. And I have to imagine he was somewhat of a deciding vote, or at least an influential one, and saying, hey, no, this is actually what's good for Twitter, right? And he's posted various things along the way of, hey, you know, Twitter's finally in the right hands and all of that stuff. And it's such a mess. And everyone's always said Twitter's a clown car, right? What was Mark Zuckerberg's old comment, that it was like a clown car that fell into a pot of money or something like that. Right. And like, here we are again. It found itself in this whole unavoidable, I think, clown car situation with Elon Musk.
Yeah, and I you know, Jack seemed to definitely have a role in putting Parag in place. It is worth noting, however, that Jack didn't want to not be CEO of Twitter. He was kind of forced into that by an activist investor called Elliot, and there was kind of a settlement of sorts that basically meant Jack would eventually step down as CEO. And I think he did pick Parag, or was instrumental in picking Parag as that replacement. But I don't think Jack wanted there to be a replacement in the first place. And I think maybe there was a little bit of, you know, screw all of you, including some members of the board who were kind of on Elliot's side as part of all that. And again, Jack has always looked up to Elon Musk. There's been a little bit of, it's not even envy. I think he's looked at Elon as a little bit of a mentor of sorts historically. And he believed in the guy and maybe still does. Maybe he thinks that that's, the spam thing is real and that Elon's gotten screwed in this. But Jack doesn't look great.
By the way, if that's true, Jack's really not going to Jack's going to be shocked to find out who was running Twitter for the last 6 years before this. If he thinks that spam bot thing's true. Last one before I let you go. This is obviously highly entertaining, right? And to some extent, it carried a podcast for me for 4 weeks or whatever until we found the dunking on crypto product market fit. But do you think that this is like a one of one situation that is unique to this unique character at this moment in time? Or is this have a bunch of broader implications for the SEC, for Delaware law, for M&A, for private, you know, take privates and all of that? How much is this just one random kind of, you know, entertaining saga versus something that actually has broad ramifications?
I think it's unique. I think it's a one-off. I think it would be very different if Elon had said, I want out of this because the market has gone to hell. And, you know, I overpaid. That would be different, right? Because if he were to have won on that, well, there's lots of people who agreed to do deals before the market went to hell. And then they could say, ah, look, we can get out of it too. But that's not what he's alleging here. I think this is a one-off. Again, this has been legitimately, you can use the word, this has been a unique situation, including how quickly this deal got put together. You know, think of other big mergers. You know, think of like, you know, Time Warner, AT&T, and how many months and months that thing was negotiated before there was a signed agreement. This is unique, and whatever the outcome is will be too. And by the way, Twitter always has been, right? When you look at big, you know, call them social media companies or consumer facing tech companies, I mean, they've had what, 4 or 5 CEOs now, you know, multiple founders in and out, fired, brought back. It's a weird company. It's always been a weird company, and it's always been a company that has been far more important and influential to kind of global politics and the global conversation than it has been in terms of a revenue generating, let alone a profitable business.
Yeah, no, I agree 100% with that. So you were very prescient the last go round in terms of how this lands. I've sort of given my perspective on some plus breakup fee version of it, and they go back to operating. What's your perspective now if you're calling your shot?
I think that I'll stick with my original thing. I think Twitter remains a publicly traded company. I agree with your analysis. I think Elon will have to pay dearly to get out of it. And I don't quite know what that number will be or how that will be structured, or if he'll agree, right? Again, the court might say, this is the number, and he might just, you know, flip two birds and say no. And then that would be fascinating for the court because they've never had somebody do that before. Elon, again, is different. But yeah, I think Twitter will continue to be a publicly traded company. Elon won't own it. It just doesn't seem to be in the cards.
And by the way, just the last one on that, like, you said once that they threatened to put someone in jail before for this, or they referred someone to
not for this per se, but the court, it wasn't about specific performance. It was about something else. Delaware Chancery Court is a civil court, right? You know, almost everything comes down to money. You owe this amount of money or you don't owe this amount of money. They don't put people in jail. They legally, in theory, could, but it's not really what they do. They're a civil court. So one time a judge in Chancery recommended somebody for criminal prosecution. But again, that's a whole separate thing. Then you need to actually get criminal. That would be recommending that somebody get criminally prosecuted. Chancery hasn't had a situation in which somebody has simply refused to abide by its ruling. I'm not saying Elon would, but if Chancery said you got to pay $20 billion, I don't know. I don't know what he would say to that.
You know, I found over the course of the last couple of years, I'm not saying Elon would is like a very risky proposition to land on. But
yeah.
Well, Dan, thanks for doing this. I appreciate you making the time. And glad we're able to do an emergency Elon Musk pod here.
I have a feeling this won't be the last one. I appreciate the time, man.